This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. We see a businessman standing at his desk with a phone to his ear. He's looking at an appointment book. A line of dialogue appears below the drawing to reveal what the man is saying to the person on the other end of the phone. No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you? Fans of The New Yorker will instantly recognize this now iconic cartoon written and drawn by the magazine's cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. It's become so popular you don't even have to read The New Yorker. You may have seen it reprinted on coffee mugs and t-shirts. It's but one example of the power of cartooning. If you're like me, comic books were a life-changing medium. I knew that Daredevil, the superhero blinded by an accident that left him with super heightened senses so acute he can tell whether a person is lying just by listening to the speed of their heartbeat, was not real, but panel by panel, I faithfully followed his adventures in Hell's Kitchen as if he was. And other comics like Spider-Man and the brilliantly satirical Howard the Duck, Please Do Not Judge Him by the Awful Movie, were a gateway to reading books without pictures later in life. But there is something about words being joined by drawings that still holds sway. Perhaps it's because comics and cartooning offer a blend of what we love most about movies and books. The narrative power of a clever story or phrase is there, joined by a visual image that doesn't move. But in that stillness, we can pore over the page multiple times, go back and go forward at the speed we choose, and find new subtleties each time we look. Today on the program, we're going to delve into the power and passion of cartoons and comics with three Vermont-based masters of the medium. Joining me in our VPR studios in Colchester is Rachel Lindsay, creator of the comic Rachel Lives Here Now, which you can find in the 7 Days newspaper. Rachel somehow dug into my brain by doing one strip that hilariously tackled a subject I've actually spent time discussing in real life, the difference between Cliff and Luna bars. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined in the studio by Robert Waldo Brunel Jr., the man behind the comic strip Mr. Brunel Explains It All. And if you want the best and funniest explanation of how climate change actually works, you should do a search of his catalog. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We also have with us from our Norwich studios today, Stephen Bissett, a comic book illustrator and teacher at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction, whose work with Alan Moore on the reinvention of the character Swamp Thing in the 1980s should be required reading for every human being on the planet. Stephen Bissett, it is such an honor to have you with us on the program today.
Thank you so much, and I hope every human being does do it. Our royalties will go up.
We'll see what happens, and we hope that you will join the conversation as well. Do you think political cartoons pack more punch than an op-ed in the New York Times? Do you think Zippy the Pinhead holds the secrets to the universe, despite or perhaps because of his love for putting taco sauce on ringdings? Did you grow up reading comic books and then gravitate to the edgier graphic novels that brought characters like Batman into new light or dark, as the case may be? You can send us a message on our VPR Facebook page or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net or just give us a call, 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And Rachel Lindsay, I want to start with you. I'd say that you're fairly new to the cartoon game, except that, I'll wager you've been making drawings and cartoons for a long time now. How did you get started in cartooning?
Well, I mean, I always drew, and I love telling stories, and I love making people laugh. So it's just kind of a natural thing for me to pick up. And then when I was in elementary and middle school, I always tried to kind of do comics instead of papers, and that worked quite well for a while. And then I had a strip in my high school paper that was really similar to Rachel Lives Here Now. It was called Thoughts On, and it was kind of the same slice of life thing. And then I went to college and tried to keep it going.
I mentioned in the intro that you did a strip that gets into the man-woman gender dynamic that's inherent in Cliff and Luna bars. I've puzzled over this myself. I've had to fess up to my wife that I'm reluctant to eat a Luna bar because it seems like it's only for women. Mm-hmm. You actually did a whole comic strip on this, and it was so funny. What was your thought process in creating that very funny strip?
I was a cashier at City Market for quite some time. And of course, when you're standing around for 8 hours ringing up groceries, different thoughts occur in your mind. And so that was one of them, that Cliff and Luna were the power couple of nutrition bars. And the fun part about that was that I sent it to them on Facebook, being a former, you know, marketing slave. I knew some 24-year-old was monitoring their Facebook, and they were like, can we tweet this? Can we send this to the whole company? And got a care package. So that worked out quite well for me. In addition to, you know, speaking to you, I got some Clif and Luna bars.
It really was so funny. I read that. I said, I can't believe that someone is actually writing about this, because I've spent time thinking about it. Robert Brunell, your strip, Mr. Brunell, explains it all. It's a no-holds-barred political comic that actually does what it says. It explains some thorny political issues, but always with sharp wit, very funny observations. What made you gravitate towards wanting to do a comic strip, especially because you come from a painting background as well, right?
Yes, I'm a painter and a kinetic sculptor and a book illustrator. And for many years, I was an art teacher at the Bronze River Middle School for 30 years. So I taught cartooning all those years. And then in 1997, the Burlington Free Press had a contest for political cartoons, amateur political cartoons. And I won it. So I said, maybe I can do something with this. So I began putting cartoons in Vermont Times newspaper. Your older listeners may remember the Vermont Times. And then in 1999, it was picked up by Funny Times, which is a national humor anthology, and then shortly thereafter, Humor Times. So that's where they are today.
Is political cartooning something that you followed in your younger days? Did you read Doonesbury or some of those related comics?
Yes. I'm interested in nearly all forms of cartooning, but because I'm a know-it-all, I figured the political cartooning would be the way to go. The title of the strip comes from the fact that I was an art teacher, so I was Mr. Brunell, and that was my job, to explain it all in the classroom.
Your comic reminds me a little bit of another comic that's being currently made with a political bent, This Modern World by Tom Tomorrow. Certainly your own strip has its own unique style and flair. Is it a fair comparison, though, for people who may be aware of that strip to compare it with yours?
Yes. Tom Tomorrow, I love his stuff. He draws in this retro style. He tries to make the cartoon look like it was made in the 1950s.
Right.
And I wouldn't say that I copy his style, but his sensibility, like him, I kind of lean to the left, even though I try to skewer both sides of the aisle equally.
Yeah, I think people will find that as they tune in. I want to get to that in a little bit too. I want to turn to Stephen Bissett now. And Stephen, I have to do that, you know, a little bit of that disclaimer thing here. I'm such a huge fan, so I'm going to gush a little bit about this. But, you know, I read your work with Alan Moore on Swamp Thing back in the day. It took a character that it really had been kind of just a creature from the Black Lagoon caricature and introduced themes of environmentalism, featured a strong female protagonist who was every bit as integral to the plot as the Swamp Thing. And I think that was kind of unusual for the 1980s too. As an illustrator, how did you approach depicting the narratives that Moore introduced, these very serious themes?
Well, bear in mind, when you're doing comics, you're not just an illustrator. That is part of the job, but I'm primarily a storyteller. The approach that we took to Swamp Thing, I was working on the book with John Tottleben, who is a Pennsylvania native. And we were working with a writer named Marty Pasco, and we were told by our editor, Len Wein, who was the co-creator of Swamp Thing, that we'd be working with this new writer from England named Alan Moore that we'd never heard of him. But John and I had. We'd been reading Warrior magazine out of the UK. And Alan's approach to scripting was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I'd been working in the field professionally since 1977, saw my first Alan Moore script in 83, and Alan's scripts were conversations to the artist. Alan would lay out in the script not only what was going to be required of us for drawing the panels and the pages, but where this was leading, what clues he wanted us to place in the art early in the issue that would be integral to how that story ended. And that ending I'm referring to might be two or three issues later. So Alan was taking an approach as a writer that I hadn't seen before. And I had drawn many scripts by that time and worked with many writers. And it was really liberating. Alan was asking something of us that no other writer had asked of us. And he had also was welcoming us in as collaborators on a level that I also hadn't experienced as yet, unless I was working with, you know, one of my buddies from the Joe Kubert School, where I graduated from in 78, including Vermont cartoonists like Rick Veitch and writers who worked in comics who were from Vermont, like Steve Perry and Tom Veitch. Alan really all of our games.
What were some of those things, Stephen, that he asked you to do that you say you'd never been asked to do before?
You know, part of it was I was of a generation that had grown up with underground comics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite unusual. In fact, the reason I wanted to work in comics was because of the underground comics, comics like Zap and underground comics like Skull and Slow Death. So Alan was tapping that underground tradition as well as mainstream comics, superhero comics and so on. The other thing is that I'm a movie junkie. You know, if I could have had access to the kind of video and videography technology that young people have today, I probably would have pursued that instead of comics. And there were filmmakers like Nicholas Roeg, who in the 70s made movies like Performance, Walkabout, Don't Look Now. I wanted to do that in comics. I wanted to have that sophisticated level of storytelling where you're really immersing the reader in a narrative experience that plays on all your senses, not just what you're seeing, but also what you smell, what you taste, and so on. And Alan was a Nicholas Roeg fan as well. And that's part of what we were trying to do in Swamp Thing, was to make a mainstream American comic book work on the same level as a novel by Stephen King, a film by Nicholas Roeg or David Cronenberg, because what was happening in all the other media around us was so exciting, but American comics were still very staid and conservative by compare.
There was such a cinematic quality to that book. There really was. And I think that comes through in your illustrations and much of the narrative that Alan Moore put forth in that. We're going to get back to some of that in a moment. We are talking about comics and cartooning today. We've got three guests with us, Rachel Lindsay, and she does Rachel Lives Here Now. You can find that in 7 days. Robert Brunel is with us. Mr. Brunel explains it all. And Stephen Bissette, the legendary illustrator who now teaches at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 800-639-2211. Rachel, I want to ask about how much of your personal life you include in your comic strips. I'm assuming it's a fair amount, given the title is Rachel Lives Here Now.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the title for that blog was just – which it started out as a webcomic back when I moved to Vermont in 2013, I should say. And, you know, you got to name your website. And I was just trying to get it out there. And I was like, man, what am I going to call this, you know? And so it was just the easiest thing that I could put out there. But, you know, subsequently people – We're interpreting it as my state of mind and kind of – it was really interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's personal, but it's not. I mean, I have other projects that are deeply personal that I'm working on, and I try to – you know, a lot of young cartoonists and people that are active doing, you know, the memoir stuff these days really gravitate towards things that are very painful. And I just try to not do that in my work and keep it pretty light. So just approaching things with an active curiosity and keeping it positive.
What were some of the comics that you enjoyed, maybe some strips that inspired you as you were getting into this?
Oh, man. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't read that many comics. Definitely Calvin and Hobbes. Duh. The common denominator, honestly. And then I read Persepolis when I was in high school, and that just, like, blew my mind. And mm-hmm. that was when I was like, whoa, like, a lot can happen with this. Like, and then when I moved to Vermont, I had access to just all of a sudden all of these amazing comics. And, you know, I loved – when I was in college, I loved Black Hole. That was another huge thing. And I got to look at some single issues of that, which was insane. And then I got, you know, really into the alternative comics, like Steve was mentioning, and just kind of recognized that as a really important precursor to the kind of work that I was doing. And more recently, David Mazzucchelli. I really, really love his work.
He did great work on Daredevil back mm-hmm. in the day with Frank Miller. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Asterios Polyp, his graphic novel is incredible. I mean, talk about visual storytelling. It's amazing. And then, of course, Alison Bechdel. I mean, just the perfect example of, like, someone who cares about draftsmanship but also is a good writer, which I feel like has gone by the wayside recently. People who can write words think they can draw pictures. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, sorry, but, you know, there's got to be a balance. And sometimes it's just you could take a little more time, you know.
and make it a little bit, you know, more sophisticated to match your narrative.
It's if you're going to call it visual, it's storytelling. Right. Tell a story visually.
Robert Purnell, you're a Vermont native.
Yes, I am.
And what about this atmosphere here? You know, Rachel was just talking about Alison Bechdel. We've got Harriet Bliss in the States. Stephen Bissette is also a Vermont native. Is there something about Vermont that brings out great cartooning and comic book artists?
Well, not just cartooning. I think art in general, as I tell my painter friends, we probably have more artists per square mile than Manhattan at this point, which means it's a great place to make art, but it's not a great place to sell art because there's just too many of us. In fact, this would be a good time to mention the Vermont Comic Creators Group was just formed. We have over 90 cartoonist members and we're still growing.
No kidding. What is this group about?
It's amateur and professional cartoonists. We get together once a month and chat. Not all 90, but it was founded by Greg Giordano and Mike Wagner. And you can find us on Facebook or on our website, Vermont Comic Creators. And we're hoping to become an organization that can actually put out books and things in the future. We're just in the beginning stages, but.
Well, I think that's another good point. You've got this group now, and I wonder about the perhaps solitary nature of what you do because, you know, this is, as Rachel was saying, you have to be able to draw as well, and I am really jealous. I love my job, but if I could do anything else other than playing center field for the Red Sox, it would be to be a cartoonist, really. And I don't have that talent to draw, but you are isolated, are you not, when you do your jobs?
Yes, we are. It's a solitary profession, which is what makes the group so great because we can get together and swap stories and talk about technique. And
But also we haven't talked in a long time, so we're all just like, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. I've learned a lot because a lot of the members have had experience in many different types of cartooning, so I just sit there and listen to them tell me stuff.
We're going to come back and talk more about cartooning, the art of comics, in just a moment. You can join the conversation as well at 800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and we are talking about comics and comic books and cartooning today. Maybe you're an aspiring cartoonist with questions on how to get into the business. You can give us a call at 800-639-2211 or post your question on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or Vermont Edition at vpr.net. We're with Rachel Lindsay, creator of the comic Rachel Lives Here Now, Robert Brunell, who does Mr. Brunell Explains It All, and Stephen Bissette, legendary illustrator, who's also a teacher at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. And Stephen Bissette, I have a question here from our own VPR producer, Sam Gale Rosen, who is apparently as big a comic book geek as I am. He wants to know if you have any favorite artists that are currently working in the industry. He says the work of J.H. Williams III, another Alan Moore collaborator, reminds him a lot of your style, and he references one of the amazing hallucinogenic love scenes between Swamp Thing and Abby in the episode Rite of Spring, one of my favorites.
God, because I teach at a cartooning school, most of my favorite cartoonists are our students and alumni because that's the work that I'm spending, you know, much of my life with. There's a lot of amazing work being done right now. Michael DeForge is a Canadian cartoonist who's been doing some work that I really love. He was originally being published by Koyama Press out of the Toronto area. I'm revisiting a lot of work by cartoonists like Skip Morrow, who's also a Vermonter. He does single panel gag cartoons, but I love Skip's work. I've also been revisiting a lot of work by Alison Bechdel. Alison lives in Vermont, and I recently pulled together out of my archives my collections of Dykes to Watch Out For. And, oh, God, Alison was doing terrific work, you know, week by week for a lot of the alternative weeklies. Most people now, of course, are aware of Alison's work on Fun Home, but boy, she was really good doing that weekly alternative strip, and she did it for a long time.
Can you give us an idea, Stephen, of what it is like at the Center for Cartoon Studies when you're teaching your students? I mean, it seems to me you're either a capable artist or you're not. Your students probably already have innate ability, but you know, do you try to hone their talents, bring out something that you see in them that they may not see in themselves, or how does it go?
Well, I'll start by trying to disperse some of the myths. I mean, comics isn't just about drawing. Prior to the Vermont Comic Creators Group, there's a group called Trees and Hills, and it was co-founded by a Vermonter, Dan Barlow, who at that time was a reporter by profession. He was a reporter for the Brattleboro Reformer and then the Rutland Herald. Dan loved comics, like you, Mitch, and didn't think he had any business trying to do them. And we were doing a 24-hour comic event at the Brattleboro Museum down in Brattleboro, Vermont, and I convinced Dan to come and try it. And it opened up a whole world, and Dan co-founded with Colin Tedford from New Hampshire a cartoonist collective that was New England-based called the Trees and Hills Group. You know, some of our students come in with impressive drawing chops, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily good storytellers. Writing is a strong component, as Rachel and Robert can attest. And the kind of writing that Rachel would do for her strip Weston the Stoner might be very different from the kind of writing Rachel's going to be doing with Rachel Lives Here Now. Robert has done illustrated books for adults and children. He's collaborating right now with Joseph Citro on a book, Vermont folklorist Joe Citro. You know, you've got to have certain skill sets but that you're refining, and you may think you're a good illustrator or a strong writer, but it's the combination of all of those skills that really feeds comics. I often use the metaphor of ballet, you know. You may be able to move your body around, but try ballet.
It's a because, lot more than that.
Yeah, doing comics is this interdisciplinary media where it's not just your illustrative skills. I can do a decent drawing and I guess I've been able to for much of my life. But can I tell a story and can I compose a page? And the challenges that face someone doing strip cartooning where you're working in the constraints of 3 to 4 panels is very different from tackling a graphic novel where you're doing, you know, 120 or more pages. There's compositional skills in doing a page that have a graphic artist component, but you can't lose sight of the writer doing the storytelling as well. And that's part of the reason why a lot of my favorite creators who work in comics are writer artists, people like Frank Miller, who also grew up in Vermont. He went to Union 32 up in East Montpelier. And Rick Veach, who I mentioned earlier, you know, your ability to hone all your skills are very important. And the kind of writing that Robert does with Mr. Brunel Explains It All is very different from what Rachel's doing and is very different from what I'm doing when I'm, you know, doing a ghost story in comics form or a project like Tyrant, which was about the birth, life, and death of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, where I'm trying to immerse the reader in what it is to be an animal in the real world.
Rachel was just giving me a thumbs up on Tyrant. I think she wants everybody to read that. We're actually going to go to the phones right now. I think you had mentioned Frank Miller, Stephen, and we may have a connection there. Cynthia is on the line from Calais. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, I just had to call. Frank is my brother-in-law, and I want to underscore what your guest just said. Frank, according to his mother, didn't really have as much drawing ability as my husband, but his brother. But you know what? Frank lived Superman and different superheroes when he was little. He'd have his pajamas on underneath his clothes, and my husband Steve would say he'd be out in the woods somewhere, Frank would disappear, and out he would come with his Superman pajamas on. And then, you know, it was the storytelling that I think really made him famous. And I was sitting next to Neil Adams at the Sin City screening, and Neil was telling me about, you know, he'd send him off. You know, he'd come in. They called him the Mountain Man. He wore his flannel shirt there, and he'd say, go back and draw hands for 6 months, you know, and Frank would. Finally, Frank was dropped off in New York City by his father and my husband, and he was literally a starving artist for a long time, and now he'll be in the history books. So
no question.
I don't have. You probably know a lot more about his work than even I do, but I had to call in.
I really appreciate the call, Cynthia. Thank you so much. Frank Miller, for those who don't know him, kind of changed the game. I mean, the reason you're seeing all these, you know, sort of dark movie depictions now of The Dark Knight, Batman, et cetera, is because Frank Miller took that character of Batman, did some great work with Daredevil 2, and took it from kind of the swashbuckling, slapdash, colorful comics into a much darker realm, but with great narrative skill and great, great dark themes that were just brilliantly done.
Frank inspired our generation. Frank doing Daredevil is part of what sparked John Taliban and I when the opportunity presented itself to work on Swamp Thing, because we'd seen what Frank had done. We'd been reading his work, and it's like, okay, we want to do that now too. And then later we became friends with Frank. We met him through comic conventions, which was wild because I grew up 15 miles from where Frank went to school. But if you weren't in band – or athletics, you weren't going to meet other cartoonists back in the 60s.
I want to throw this question out to the panel, really, because a couple of people want to know about getting involved in the business. Travis emailed us, as a budding comic book artist author with my first book wrapping up in June, can the panelists offer any tips for self-publishing in Vermont? Alternatively, can they offer insights on getting published in Vermont at all? Robert, you want to start?
Yeah, I self-publish all of my cartoon anthologies. Every year I gather the best of that year and do a look back. And I've been using a site called Lulu.com, and I find it very user-friendly, and there's no upfront cost, which is important for us poor starving artists.
And Rachel, how about you? Did you self-publish much of your work before getting picked up by papers?
I mean, it's really expensive. And I mean, it depends what you're going for. I think that it's a medium-specific thing. Like if you're doing a graphic novel, it's going to be a different kind of thing. And my comic series, The Wizard of Life, I wanted it to look and feel like a comic book. I didn't want it to be silkscreen. I didn't want it to be photocopied. I wanted it to feel like a book. And so I printed that through RA Comics Direct. It's in California. When that proof came in the mail, I like cried because I had been seeing it on a screen. But I highly recommend them. You just – where you got to watch out is where you put the price point, because you want to get exposure. You want people to buy it. You want to keep it low, but you also don't want to get ripped off. So you just got to be careful about that. But just get it out there.
Just get it out there and keep working, I'm sure. Tim posted this comment on Facebook. He says, in the late 80s, I spent an evening with friends. A Far Side comic book lay on the kitchen counter. I opened it and started reading. Now I was used to receiving comics in single doses via the papers, but reading Far Side comics one after the other had me in hysterics. Sitting on a kitchen stool, I tried to keep breathing, tried to stay upright, tried to talk, tried to show the comic to my friends. Nothing. I was gone. Good memories. And this is kind of interesting. Silas posted that Lunig's Bistro in Burlington, originally co-founded by Laura Thompson and Dennis Morisseau, was named after a famous cartoonist, Michael Lunick. I did not know this. And you're nodding your head there, Robert.
I did know that. I remember reading about that, I think, back in the 80s.
Wow. So, again, the Vermont connections here are just unbelievable. Stephen Bissett, working on Swamp Thing, as you said, you were inspired by Frank Miller. I want your take on what you think of some of the movie adaptations now. I mean, this is such big business for Hollywood. They see nothing but dollar signs. And I have a mixed bag feeling about this myself, because I revered those comics, as I'm sure that you did. And I don't think they get it as right as they should. Some of them are better than others. Alan Moore very famously has said he will not even go to see any of the movie adaptations that have been done of his books. What do you think about how Hollywood has tackled this?
There's been some terrific comics that were adapted into film and it fell down as movies. They just don't work as movies. But there's also been some amazing adaptations of comics into film and graphic novels into film that people don't tend to think of off the top of their head because, we're only aware of the coming Avengers movie or Batman versus Superman movie. You know, movies like American Splendor, which was based on Harvey Pekar's autobiographical comic. And Harvey didn't do it alone. He was a writer, not an artist. He had a whole group of artists that worked regularly with him. That was a terrific movie, and it was terrific on multiple levels. It featured, an actor playing Harvey Pekar. It featured Harvey himself and his wife, Joyce Brabner, who were also characters in the film, and animation of Harvey Pekar's cartoon self based on how artist Gary Dumm had drawn him in the early American Splendors. God, there's some wonderful comic-based films. One of my favorites is a film from 1967 called Diabolik. It was released in America as Danger Diabolik. Hmm. But those are the kind of movies we don't think of. We're only thinking of the big budget, you know, summer blockbusters. The next torrent is starting, I think, this weekend, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, the Civil War thing, yeah.
But there are some – I just saw Diary of a Teenage Girl up at the Savoy Theater late last year, earlier this year. That's based on a graphic novel by Phoebe Gluckner, and that was an incredible movie. But people don't talk about it as a comics movie because they are always thinking of, you know, characters in tights with superheroes fighting right. apocalyptic menaces. And that's true going all the way back to the silent era. Most people, if you had asked them then about comics movies, they would only think of the comic strip adaptations. There were, one of the first movies made from comics was a ripoff of Happy Hooligan, one of the early American comic strips. My mom would have thought of Little Abner, you know, which had sure. had two movie versions, the second one based on a very successful Broadway production.
And there was a whole series of Blondie movies in the 40s, as I recall.
Yeah. Actually, Robert, one of my trick questions for my students is what comic yielded the most feature films? And it's Blondie. There were over 32 Blondie feature films.
Amazing. What's the one, and maybe the panel here, I'm forgetting it. Maybe it was based on a Chris Ware comic. Was it Ghost?
That's a Dan Clowes.
Dan Clowes, I'm sorry.
Man.
Yes, that's right. Dan Clowes was great. There was a pretty good film adaptation of that one that was made. Rachel, what about you? Are you a fan of comics being adapted into movies back and forth, or are you more of a purist when it comes to your art form?
Well, I'm glad that Steve mentioned Dan Clowes, and he was another really important influence on me. 8-Ball is the most incredible satirical comic ever. I mean, and it's funny because I just read his new book, Patience, and, you know, which is like, oh, tour de force, da-da-da. But it just doesn't have the same effect. And he does a lot of films now. I think Wilson is being made into a film. And there seems to be this kind of reflexivity between, like, film adaptations of his work and the way he's drawing now, at least in my opinion. If I have The Complete 8-Ball, reading The Complete 8-Ball and reading Patience is like night and day. Hmm. It's like you're seeing this sort of like film. It just looks like, you know, you might draw a storyboard. There's no – the details in the character's face are not there. He doesn't use the same, you know, diversity of style. And the words, it's just less important. And, you know, that's – whatever he's exploring is great. I love him. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder, you know.
Yeah, what's happening with that? You know, it's interesting. You mentioned all these titles. And for people that may want to get into the comic book world, is it easy, Robert, to walk into a comic book store and say, you know, hey, I've heard all these great titles. I don't know where to start. Are you going to get kind of the short shrift there, you know, from – you know, is it too insider baseball?
Well, yes and no. It depends on your genre. I'm kind of the odd man out because I'm a political cartoonist, which is a little different than what these guys are talking about.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I know Earth Prime Comics here in Burlington has been very nice about selling people's work of local creators.
What about some events that may be coming up soon that you guys would like to let people know about?
Yes, very quickly, the Vermont Comic Con is happening August 27th and 28th at the Sheraton Hotel in Williston Road. Rachel and I will be there as well as many of our fellow cartoonists. It's going to be a lot of fun. Hopefully the book that I'm working on with Joe Citro, The Vermont Ghost Experience, we're hoping to have it published in time for that. So you'll be able to catch a copy of that.
Yeah, and this weekend, Waking Windows in Winooski is happening. There's going to be an artist's market there on Saturday from 2 to 7. And then I'll also have a table at the Ruff Francis show on Saturday night.
Stephen Bissett, just about a minute left here. I'm going to give the final word to you. What is it about cartooning, about comics, about this visual medium that has made it your life's passion?
Oh, God. It's, you know, it has the fewest filters. Whatever I put down on paper and hand to a person to read or look at, it's a direct current. I don't have this mountain of middlemen or gatekeepers between us. And that's pretty true with published comics as well. You know, what Rachel puts down on paper, what Robert puts down on paper or on their Wacom tablet if they're working digitally, I am seeing directly what they put down. I guess I should also mention, This Saturday is our block party at the Center for Cartoon Studies, our 10th anniversary. That's where I'll be. And I'll also be at the Latches Theater Sunday at 4:30, introducing and serving on a panel with Nora Jacobson and Paul Carnahan. We're showing A Vermont Romance, 1916 restored Vermont film.
Fantastic. Well, I want to thank our panel of wonderfully talented cartoonists today, Robert Waldo Brunell Jr., creator of Mr. Brunell Explains It All. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Rachel Lindsay writes, Rachel Lives Here Now. Check it out in 7 days. Thank you, Rachel, so much.
Thank you so much.
And Stephen Bissett, known for his work on the saga of Swamp Thing, Taboo, and much more, now teaches at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. Stephen, it's been a real honor. Thank you.
This has been great. Have us on again, please.
Oh, please. I'm going to lobby for it. This Saturday, 21,000 volunteers will cover 13,000 miles of Vermont roads to pick up 200 tons of trash. Saturday is Green Up Day, and we'll learn more about that just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. This weekend, you will likely see groups of volunteers on the roadsides of your town collecting litter in bright green plastic bags. Saturday is the 46th annual Green Up Day. VPR's Patty Daniels talked with the president of Green Up Vermont, Melinda View, about the longstanding anti-litter tradition.
Green Up is a familiar idea. It's a familiar concept to a lot of Vermonters, but remind us what the origin story is of Green Up Day. How did this institution first begin?
It was launched in 1970 by Governor Dean Davis, and a Vermont citizen had come to him the year before, actually in 1969, because there was so much litter along the roadsides and especially along the interstate, and that person had the idea of marshaling an army of thousands of volunteers to clean up the roadsides all throughout Vermont. And so they started working on it, and there was so much interest that Governor Davis said, I think we've got a bear by the tail. We're going to stop and plan this thing for a year and make it right.
And my understanding of that history is that there were helicopter rides involved. The Congress agreed to shut down the interstate highway system in Vermont for that day. There's sort of a mythology about that very first Green Up Day.
Very much so. And yes, I mean, whoever and wherever have they closed down an interstate from 9 to noon so that people like Cub Scouts could get out on the interstate and clean up litter. And we even had national news coverage. So it was phenomenal. This was a time when the first Earth Day was 4 years after the first Green Up Day. You know, we like to be first and everything. But that being said, it showed that there were people in different parts of the world who were thinking similar things. In other words, the environment, the impact that humans are having on the environment.
And so fast forward to 2016, what does Green Up Day look like now? How many people are involved? How widespread is the effort?
In every town, there is a Green Up Day. We don't require towns to do Green Up Day exactly one way or the other. So each community determines how they're going to carry out Green Up Day. So in some communities, it's only on Green Up Day, and you go to the fire station or the schoolhouse or the town hall or the rec field to pick up your bags, and then people go out along the roads. And then in some towns, you can leave the bags along the roadside, and sometimes you cannot. And in other towns, they take them to wherever the town garage is. So it's a variation on the theme throughout the whole state.
And there are these bright green trash bags. And after the Green Up weekend, it's like you see them all over the place. It's sort of a visual demonstration of how much trash had been out there a few days earlier.
It's wonderful. They're yummy sunshine green bags. And believe me, it took us a while to get to that. The first bags were dark green and just not happy fun. And yes, you're right. They just show that all this work is being done in all our communities.
Give us some numbers. How many people participate and how many bags or pounds of trash are collected every year?
We are now up to over 21,000 people participating.
And how much trash is collected year over year?
Lots. And that's another one that's hard for us because in some towns a little truck will go to the dump, you know, they'll have a big dumpster and they don't know. So that's a hard one, but well over 200 tons. And so, you know, that's both the good news and the bad news. Someone said to me, well, the good news is we removed 200 tons of garbage from our roadsides. The bad news is we had 200 tons of garbage on our roadsides. So it's a mixed thing. When the media asks me, which is more important, the amount of trash picked up or the amount of spirit raised? I say the amount of spirit raised. Communities come together on Green Up Day in a way they no other time of the year. There's just no other day like it in the year. And I tell people to go out on Green Up Day, you know, even if you're not going with a crowd of people to pick up, go out and know that there are thousands of people all around the state picking up litter along our roadsides. I get chills whenever I do that.
Talk me through the mindset that you imagine of the person who has a piece of trash in their hand and throws it out the window. Like, how does that decision process get made, and how, you know, aggravating is that for you to think about when you see your volunteers out picking up that trash on Green Up Day?
I don't have an answer. However, because I really don't understand it, and we, you know, in conversation with people, none of us understand how could people possibly toss trash out the window. A lot of research has been done, and there are certain age groups that it's figured that they are the ones, you know, throwing things out most. One of the thoughts is that a lot of beer, you know, alcohol stuff gets thrown out, and the thought is they don't want to arrive home with that kind of stuff in their car. So there are all those kinds of thoughts.
What age groups are most commonly the perpetrators of litter?
I think it's late teens to 35.
Ugh.
Okay, guys.
As you drive around the state, do you take notice of areas that you're seeing a lot of trash, and do you think, oh, I can't wait to get back there?
Oh, my gosh. Do you think I can drive along our roads and not see litter? I mean, we're talking 20 years of driving along our roadsides and seeing litter. I just can't not notice it. So I certainly notice it. And from year to year, it actually has varied. We've noticed that some years there seems to be less litter, but then other years there seems to be more. Actually, this year is one of those where I've been seeing quite a bit of litter. Green Up Day focuses on roads in communities. We are not encouraged to clean up state highways, along state highways, and the interstate. Vermont does not allow volunteers on the interstate. But the number of miles is, for our state highways, is about 2,700 miles. Our roads that Green Up Day volunteers focus on is 13,000. That's a lot.
So Vermont is in the process of phasing in a multi-year universal recycling law that addresses recyclables, composting, trash. How does the material that people collect on Green Up Day fit into that law?
Well, actually, Green Up Day has an exemption from the Agency of Natural Resources so that Green Up volunteers are not required to separate for recycling. It's really important that the recyclables are clean. If they are dirty, they're rejected, they can contaminate an entire batch. So it's very important that dirty recyclables do not go to recycling.
Any precautions as far as safety that volunteers should be thinking about? There's, you know, a lot of times people will be picking up needles or broken glass. What advice do you have for participants?
Yes, definitely. Caution about safety. The litter of the present is not the litter of the past, unfortunately. And in terms of picking up needles, our position is do not pick up needles. What volunteers are to do is to inform their town coordinator. Their town coordinator then will tell their local officials. And so that's what people are to do. Yes, pay attention and go to our website to see examples of what could be hazardous waste, like the needles, the things associated with meth labs. So definitely safety is important.
How does the effort of actually cleaning up the trash connect to any kind of prevention efforts to stop the trash from getting out there in the first place?
There's not really. I've even asked successful businesses who are highly into marketing if they could help change behavior, and they said no. So there's not. What I will say is that I firmly believe that, based on feedback that I get, that the visibility of Green Up Day makes a difference. I don't meet anybody that doesn't know about Green Up Day. And with our writing contest, with the entries we got this year from 6th and 7th graders especially, lots of those entries said that they go out with family, and that they really enjoy that time together. And they say that it's about taking care of their community and taking care of the environment and the world and animals. Now, how cool is that?
Why is this a passion for you? Recycling, trash, getting this material out of the environment. What drives you to stay committed to this work?
You know, it's not so much what you just listed. I moved here in 1970 from Kansas and Oklahoma. And when I came here, this was it for me. And when I would go back to visit in the Midwest, people would say to me, you should work for the Chamber of Commerce, because I talked so favorably about Vermont. And when the Green Up job came up, I was drawn to it. And for me, it really was more about taking care of Vermont. And for me, seeing litter along the roadsides is such a disrespect and such a distraction from the natural beauty of Vermont that's what has driven me. And now, since that beginning, I do care about trash, and I do care about reducing the amount of trash that human beings create and the importance of taking care of the planet. I think that Green Up Day is our part in helping to take care of the planet.
That's Melinda View, president of the nonprofit Green Up Vermont. The annual Green Up Day is this Saturday, and it's not too late to connect with Green Up efforts in your town. Go to greenupvermont.org for details. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll be joined by Alan Gilbert, outgoing executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Vermont. We'll talk about the state privacy bill, roadside marijuana tests, DNA collection policies, and more. Send your questions or comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and tune in live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Thank you so much for listening.